Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc Forum called Environmental Justice, Dead or Just Napping. Speaking with us today, we have Michael Buschbacher, Horace Cooper, John Cruden, and Matthew Tejada. And moderating the discussion, we have John Irving, who is a partner at Earth and Water Law. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, John, thank you so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thanks, Edie. Much appreciated. Hello and welcome, everyone. Very much appreciate you, our panelists, and everyone else for being here. This is brought to you in the Federalist Society's proud tradition of promoting thoughtful discussions about key issues between distinguished speakers with differing views. Just a little bit more on our panelists today. Michael Buschbacher is a partner at Boyd & Gray. He served as counsel to the AAG for the Justice Department's Environment and Natural Resources Division. We have Horace Cooper, senior fellow with the National Center for Public Policy Research, chairman of the Project 21 National Advisory Board, and a previous professor of constitutional law at George Mason University, and as senior counsel to House Majority Leader Dick Armey. John Cruden is a principal of Beveridge and Diamond. He served as the Assistant Attorney General for DOJ's Environment Division in the Obama administration. He's also served as the Chief of DOJ's Environmental Enforcement Section, and then as the ENRD Career Deputy AAG under Presidents Bush, Clinton, W. Bush, and Obama. And that was all after serving in the United States Army, Airborne Ranger, and Special Forces units in Germany and Vietnam, after graduating from West Point, serving as an Army JAG, and as the president of DC Bar. So definitely have my resume beat. Matt Tejada is Senior Vice President of Environmental Health at the National Resources Defense Council. He served as the Deputy Assistant Administrator of EPA's Office of Environmental Justice and External Civil Rights in President Biden's administration. So thank you all for taking the time to join us for this discussion. Thank you also to Jeff Wood of Baker Botts and the leader of this practice group, FedSoc Assistant Director Edie Harold, and Brent Fuel, who is my partner at Earth and Water Law, for making this panel discussion possible. So just before we go into the discussion, I'm gonna try to give a brief explanation of environmental justice and where it's been and where it is now. The concept is that low income and minority communities disproportionately bear the brunt of pollution and environmental harm, and that affirmative steps need to be taken to address that problem. Critics argue that EJ further bloats the administrative state, functions as a wealth redistribution scheme, and unlawfully injects racial considerations into agency decision-making, particularly with respect to enforcement and the award of billions of dollars in grant funds. So the federal government's EJ efforts have evolved over the years. President Clinton issued an executive order in 1994 directing federal agencies to make achieving EJ part of its mission by identifying and addressing, as appropriate, disproportionately high and adverse human health or environmental effects of its programs, policies, and activities on minority populations and low-income populations in the United States. That was followed up by President Biden's executive order in 2021 that had more specific environmental justice efforts, made environmental justice the mission of every agency and directed enforcement through EPA, DOJ, and DHHS. It established two EJ-related White House advisory councils, created the Justice 40 initiative, whereby 40% of the federal benefits were to be focused on disadvantaged communities, and used EPA's EJ Screen database to create a climate and EJ screening tool. Agencies were also directed to assume disproportionate impacts based on demographic makeup of the community. That executive order was implemented by then EPA Administrator Michael Reagan, who directed all EPA offices to clearly integrate EJ into their plans and actions. EPA's Office of Enforcement and Compliance Assurance, OECA, then issued three guidance memoranda along that line, those lines. And there was also implementation by the Justice Department in 2022. There was a memo by then AG Merrick Garland titled Actions to Advance Environmental Justice. And there was also a similar memorandum by Associate Attorney General Vinod Gupta. On the other hand, in January 2025, President Trump issued Executive Order 14173 titled Ending Illegal Discrimination and Restoring Merit-Based Opportunity, ordering all executive departments and agencies to terminate all discriminatory and illegal preferences, mandates, policies, programs, activities, guidance, regulations, enforcement actions, consent orders, and requirements. The order specifically revoked President Clinton's earlier executive order, and President Biden's executive order had already been rescinded. So that was implemented by EPA in various ways that we'll get into, and also by DOJ in a memorandum by Attorney General Pam Bondi titled Rescinding Environmental Justice. And doing exactly that, it said going forward, the department will even-handedly enforce all federal civil and criminal laws, including environmental laws. Right. So, among the things that have been done recently, there was an article just the other day about round four of cuts at EPA by Administrator Zeldin. The first one of those was on March 10. That was and the most directly related to our conversation. It was a cut of $20 billion in EJ or climate change grant funds from the Inflation Reduction Act's Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, which was awarded to eight groups, including the Climate United Fund, $7 billion there, and Coalition for Green Capital, $5 billion there, both of which are now suing EPA and Citibank over freezing those awards. So I guess, I'll stop talking and let's do a kind of a quick round where, everybody kind of gives their, a few minutes of where they think we are and what the implications for this are. Horace, Cooper, why don't we start with you?
Well, good afternoon. It's great to be able to participate in this panel. And I joined the Federalist Society when I was a student, as a law school student. And I'm really privileged to be able to participate because these kinds of forum I find very important. The topic today is one that I find both exciting and troubling. It is troubling to me that we have a situation where government, the federal government in particular, but government uses its coercive power to pick racial winners and losers, to use race as a talisman for how it is going to assess or measure its achievements. In this case, we are told the goal is to make improvements for the environment. The goal is that minorities and working class and other marginalized communities are going to be better off. And it turns out, if you look at the end results, that they're not actually better off. In some instances, particularly minority communities, they are worse off. And it's not unlike the last major and comprehensive effort undertaken in the United States. It was called Jim Crow, that used race as a talisman for measuring. Now, we all dismiss rightly, the immorality of race-based segregation. But there are other economic impacts that I think are also important. Even though advocates of Jim Crow said it was good for America, said it was good for Blacks, said it was good for whites, it turned out, again, it was good for neither. It is a primary reason, this government coercion and distortion of the use of resources that created greater poverty in the South, and it does so with the environmental agenda as well. Development opportunities in inner city communities, which are needed most as a way to allow people lessen the wealth gap, or impacted and reduced and prevented in large instances by these. The environmental community, by and large, is disproportionately made up of an army of elites. They happen to be whites. When you look at Jim Crow, again, its advocates were largely made up of elites, mostly from the South and white. They didn't help Black Americans, and they didn't help poor working class or even middle class Americans. I'll close with this. If you were a car dealer in 1929 and you sold cars in the South, you sold fewer cars because you were limited on your ability to sell Cadillacs or Oldsmobiles or other so-called higher-end vehicles to racial minorities. If you operated that same dealership in Chicago, you could sell to everyone and you sold more cars. A seamstress had the same phenomenon. A housing contractor had the same phenomenon. As a result, real estate prices were depressed in the South. As a result, middle income opportunities for both whites and Blacks were restricted in the South. It's an amazing contrast to see that now that the South no longer has these kinds of policies, that the South is an economic powerhouse. Since at least as early as the Obama administration, but perhaps earlier, we've been able to see with these environmental regulations that they have had similar effects, widening the race wealth gap, widening, not lessening, let's say it that way, not lessening racial health disparities, and creating more hurdles for opportunities to form in the very communities that many Americans agree need help most. These target like a laser to thwart that opportunity. And for the same reason that Jim Crow didn't work economically, these policies today of environmental justice don't work economically today either.
Thank you. Matt, what would you have been the most recently involved at a very high level at EPA and the most experienced with the application of EJ? What would you have to say about that? Or about EJ in general? I mean,
I don't know where to start. I'm going to start with there's a lot of ugliness in our world right now and a lot of meanness. And on my whole bike ride in this morning, I was promising myself, trying to talk myself into that, especially for this conversation today, to try to approach it from an attitude of peace and love and grace. And I'm struggling with that for a moment because the idea that we're equating environmental justice to Jim Crow is asinine, offensive, and preposterous. Jim Crow was clearly a system designed to oppress people of color in our country. It was designed to disenfranchise them, to keep them from their constitutional rights. It was designed to keep them out of economic opportunity. It was designed to keep them poor and hungry and sick. That is the exact opposite of what environmental justice has always strived to accomplish. Our country has, for its entire history, preferenced race. It has preferenced white race. It has specifically preferenced wealthy white male people in our country. The result of that is clear, that we still have vast differences in our country between men and women. We have vast differences in our country between white people and people of color and indigenous people. You can see that in educational outcomes. You can see that in economic outcomes. You can see that in health outcomes. You can see that in the fact that here in DC, if I walk 3 miles due east, suddenly people live 10 years less than people that live where I'm standing right now. That's the result of how this country has treated those people through government policies, through social policies, through our economic system, going back to before our country was a country. What environmental justice is attempting to do, and I do agree it hasn't been successful, Horace, because we were just starting. We were just starting to actually make our country more just in just the last 3 or 4 years. We were just starting to actually do things with our government that, we should probably do something about the fact that those folks are always sick over there and they live a lot less because, you know, one, it's not right, but two, God, what an economic drag on our entire country for doing so. What do they need over there? Oh, you mean they don't have clean drinking water? Why don't they have clean drinking water? Well, it's because we never give them enough money to have clean drinking water. You know what it's really hard to do if you don't have clean drinking water? It's to be healthy. You know what's really hard to do if you don't have clean drinking water? It's to actually have economic development in your community. You know what's really hard to sustain if you don't have clean drinking water and economic development? It's clean drinking water. This was not about preferencing communities. This was about recognizing the fact that our country has been racist for a long time, and we're still living with the results. We still need to address the systems and structures underlying our country, not to preference those individuals to give them something special, but to bring communities, black and brown communities, and low-income white communities that have faced the same sorts of oppression because of their wealth instead of their race. And environmental justice has always been about all of those communities. It is about trying to actually close the gap that has been created very purposefully by things like Jim Crow, because it is unfair. And if all we do today is to treat those communities fairly when that gap exists, we are just locking in that unfairness, that disparity, that difference for generations into the future. If you're okay with that, I mean, I don't know what to say about that, but I think most folks say, well, that's not fair. Your life shouldn't be determined by where you're born, by who you're born, by what language you speak as you grow up. It shouldn't be determined by the color of your skin. It is, though. That's the fact. That's the fact that the color of your skin in this country does largely determine what sort of outcomes you're going to have in our society. That's not right. All environmental justice is doing is to lifting up the voices of those communities that have been suffering and trying to get our government to understand that our government isn't serving them. That's why it's so hard to respond to you, Horace. There's some things in there that I agree with. Our environmental system has not protected those communities. Part of the reason why is because that environmental system was not designed by those communities. I agree with the fact the environmental movement has been a racist movement for a long time. It's one of the reasons I joined an environmental organization, though, because I think the environmental movement is actually, in these last several years, in these last 5 or 10 years, is really making progress, authentically trying to not be a racist movement. And I want to help them in doing that, just like I went to EPA to help EPA actually do better. We should do better. And that makes us ask challenging questions. It makes us have really hard conversations. But it is not the same as Jim Crow. It is the exact opposite of that.
Thank you. So we've certainly dove right on into the deep end here. why don't I ask Horace, let me give you an opportunity to respond, and then let me get some thoughts from John and Michael.
Okay. I want to make sure that we're all on the same page. When the advocates of Jim Crow were asked what they were doing, they claimed it was good for America, particularly in the South, and they claimed it was good for Blacks, and they claimed it was good for whites. What I will argue is it ended up being good for white elites, it was bad for whites generally, and it was awful for Black Americans. A nearly all white environmental movement now comes forward and it says it wants to use the coercive power of the state to allocate resources and decide where factories are going to be built, whose school buses are going to get new low emission apparatus added to them, have fundamentally the same problem. The truth of the matter is that the wealth gap can be reduced. It is not determinant based on your race or your DNA or your gender, but unleashing the power of the free market. Allow people of goodwill, even a few who don't have goodwill, all to come together in the marketplace and compete. What you will see is the kind of wealth generation that has affected. Just take the 4 years of the first Trump administration. Black people gained more employment versus the rest of the country than we had seen in nearly 50 years, nearly 100 years. We saw record lows in unemployment. Ford Motor Company announced more Black Americans bought a new Ford pickup truck than they had any time since they'd been offering it available. The truth of the matter is more Black Americans sent their kids off to college, more Black Americans bought homes, and that happened because we freed up markets. Over the last 4 years, what we have seen is the exact opposite. Cars on the road today are older now than they have been since 2014. More Black Americans have had their homes foreclosed upon. More minority communities, more working class communities are suffering. As long as the government continues to pursue macro policies where it assumes that it can make choices better than the free market can, and it does so on the basis of race, this harm continues. And that's why I am enthusiastically welcoming the conclusion of this chapter of this race-based policy system.
Great. Thank you. John, you have seen this evolve in your various positions, high level positions in the Justice Department, and working closely with EPA. You have a historical perspective that I think would be helpful. What do you think of? What do you make of all of this?
I have a simplistic view of environmental justice and what it brings to the table. I've told this story before, but my daughter for many years was a first grade teacher, and occasionally I would go into her class and read stories and read books. And when I did that, I could see the sign on the door, her name was Kristen, which was Kristen's rules. You know, one of them was, if you have to go to the bathroom, raise your hand. But the second one was, if you make a mess, clean it up. And I thought we could probably take away most of our environmental statutes and just have that premise environmentally, that if you have a mess, clean it up. And that's not race-based, right? That is just a mess. My simplistic view of what environmental justice was about, and others may disagree, is if you have an overburdened community, don't make it worse. If you're dealing with an overburdened community, give them a voice in the process about what's going to happen in their community. And then finally, if there is and you find environmental violations, go after them. That was kind of my view of what was trying to be accomplished in environmental justice, is to give a voice to the voiceless, to give a chance for communities to be involved and try not to make their life worse, because we all know that there are overburdened communities that have a disproportionate level of harm to them, and we ought not make that worse. If possible, we ought to try to improve that, but we certainly ought not make that worse. So I did that when I was at the Department of Justice. I'm talking to corporations right now, and I'm a little afraid we're going to lose some of what I consider to be common sense right now. It is common sense. I'm talking to corporations all the time. You want to have a good relationship with the, with that community that's around you for all kinds of reasons. You want to have that kind of relationship. And so if you can help by being transparent, if you can help by making sure they have a voice in some of the things that may well affect them, I don't know if we call that environmental justice or just good business practices. I don't know what that is, but I don't want to lose that. I don't want to lose that in what we're going, and I don't want to obscure it in some fog of racial issues, frankly. I want this to be environmental justice, which is primarily looking at trying to take overburdened communities and not make their life worse.
Fantastic. Thank you. Michael, your thoughts? I mean, if the purpose of EJ is to, you know, address historical inequities and disadvantaged communities, well, from a conservative perspective, what's wrong with that?
So I think you got to define your terms first. So one of the things that really struck me about EJ back when I first started looking at it at DOJ was that, like a lot of civil rights lingo, it seems to mean two completely opposite things at the same time. So sometimes it's things like, you know, what Matt said, not to preference. If you look at the EPA definition that they had for many years, right, just it's basically applying non-discrimination principles to ensure fair treatment of everybody regardless of race, and to make sure we're cleaning up the biggest messes and that we're focusing on that with environmental enforcement and environmental policy. And then you have, on the other hand, and often in practice, where environmental justice involved crude race-based decision-making to prioritize certain disadvantaged, in quotation marks, right, minority groups over others in environmental law. And, you know, just as an initial observation, right, it's kind of interesting to me that you have this contradiction in this definition. And I think part of it is like what I'd call a Mott and Bailey, where there's like a broad argument you make, and then you have a narrow argument that you make when you get challenged on it. So, you know, hey, we want to engage in race-based redistribution of resources is like the Mott argument. And then the Bailey argument is like, hey, look, we're just trying to do nice things to make sure that everyone benefits. So there's some of that. There's also some of what like Michael Anton calls the celebration parallax, where whether something is happening or not depends on whether you're celebrating it. So, you know, the Anton phrases this, it's not happening and it's good that it is. But I think there's a deeper reality to it too, which is like this, you know, remember the Kamala Harris equity video that she put out back in 2020, sort of like Ibram Kendi style belief. I think it's got kind of three points. One, all people groups are the same in all relevant respects. So two, any disparity between racial or ethnic groups that's arisen has at its root disparate treatment and discrimination. And three, that equal treatment forward isn't going to cut it. So quote Kendi, I wrote this down, the only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. And in order to treat some persons equally, we must treat them differently. So it's not 2020 anymore. I don't think I need to belabor the point that I think that is misguided in some pretty significant ways. But I think what we saw over the last few years from the Biden administration was much more of the second definition and not so much the kind of first one. The Denka case that the Department of Justice just dropped is a Louisiana case. And what they did in choosing this case was they used a program that you mentioned, EJ Screen. And that, like, it's got demographic data and it's got economic data. So if you're just looking at like who's challenged financially or what are the health outcomes, that's not how it broke things down. What it did is it broke them down on the basis of race, and they identified areas around the facility with sufficiently high percentages of, you know, minorities that they made the decision to enforce that there. And DOJ, as part of these new Trump era policies, dropped that. And, you know, I think the acting assistant attorney general, Adam Gustafson, put it really well when he said that in dismissing it, that was arising from their commitment to enforce environmental law, quote, consistently, fairly, and without regard to race. And so, and it's not just that, like there's an OIG, EPA OIG, Office of Inspector General report on benzene pollution. And it literally recommended used EJ screen, and it recommended bringing some suits again, and who should you triage to bring first these lawsuits against? And it has like a chart, and it's got like it's a bar chart. Some of the bars concern race, and others economic well-being in those communities. So I think if all we want to do is considering economics and things like that, that's not dead, to answer kind of the question of this panel. But if it's about overlaying some like race-based considerations into that, I do think that that's dead. And I think it's not just like a good idea. That's also constitutionally required, right? If you look at cases like Students for Fair Admission that make clear that the only justifications for racist discrimination are to undo specific identifiable concrete actions that the government has previously taken to discriminate on the basis of race. And it needs to satisfy strict scrutiny, right? Even if you have that compelling interest. Shaw versus Reno is another relevant case, right? That held that intentionally gerrymandering voting districts based on racial makeup has to satisfy strict scrutiny. And here it's going to be the very odd case that you have specific intentional discrimination that you're undoing with this specific action. I mean, no one denies that there is generalized societal discrimination. And no one denies, you know, you go to Matt's point, no one denies that this had terrible effects that were directed at Black Americans in particular, and that those effects redound to this day in a lot of different ways. What the Supreme Court has said, and I think they're right in interpreting the Constitution, is that, you know, this is the quote from Chief Justice Roberts, the way to end discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. And is that a perfect solution? I don't think anyone has suggested that it is. But if you're adding race into it again, that, you know, the cure risks being worse than the disease. And, you know, this outrageous, candidly outrageous funding things that we saw at the end of the Biden administration, I think also further underscore this. You mentioned some of these, John, but like these are some of these groups, like I think it's Climate Justice Alliance was then giving money to a group called the Hip Hop Caucus that was spending it for Democrat get out the vote efforts. And that kind of thing is just it removes the credibility of these kinds of arguments, as far as I'm concerned, that this is just about treating people fairly. It makes it seem, and I think it is, about rewarding your political friends and punishing your political enemies. And that's why it's like, it's not that these funds went to actually improving, you know, folks' lives in environmental justice communities, as they used to be called, but it's about rewarding, you know, environmental NGOs that are aligned with your political movement. I think it was very reckless of the prior administration to push in that direction. There's a reason why the Trump administration didn't get rid of the Clinton era EJ order back in the first term. I think they abused it, and now it's gone. And I think that's good. And I think it is good for environmental justice. I think we're going to see more equitable enforcement going forward. And just last point I'll say is, like, I don't think that means cutting out economic considerations. I think, to pick a good conservative example that I support, right, one of the problems with the Clean Power Plan, it's a cap and trade program that was, you know, designed to decarbonize the energy generation sector. The effect of that cap and trade program, had it ever gone into effect, would have been to make, you know, poor West Virginians subsidize rich Californians in generating, you know, in paying for their electricity. So I think that would, you know, I have a problem with that. I think it's reasonable to consider these distributing justice questions, but there's no need, and I think it's very wrong and unconstitutional, to have a racial overlay, as to borrow Horace's phrase, right, as a talisman or a token of what, you know, as tracking something else. If you have to track wealth or health outcomes, that's fine. There's no reason to add race into it.
Thanks, Michael. Matt.
Thank
so
you.
Let me just. I was going to turn to you anyway, but you know. So in part, let me ask. You know, is this really about enforcement, or is it about grant money going to political cronies? Or
I want to challenge that first. I mean, if folks are saying that environmental or climate justice organizations are not allowed to do the same thing that every other organization in this town, including yours, does, which is play the C3 game and the C4 game and have relationships that are political and have relationships that are straight up about nonprofiting and advocacy and building community, then somebody read me that part of the Constitution that says that they're prohibited from doing that. Now, if an organization is actually cooking the books and using money for C4 purposes that is not supposed to be, and it's supposed to be only C3 purposes, then you're goddamn right they should be caught out for it. Somebody wants to make that allegation against any of those organizations, please do, but you better have some evidence for it first, because it's not right. And we'd expect this organization or any other organization represented in this meeting to play by those same rules as we would for those environmental justice organizations. Also, if somebody wants to point out to me the decision that the last administration or previous administrations made based upon race, please do so. And when you do, give me back the thousands of hours of my life that I sat in the general counsel's office at EPA and with John's folks over at DOJ, ensuring that we were not using race to make those decisions. All right, because they are not based upon that. Do they use race in EJ Screen? Absolutely. I should know. I ran EJ Screen for a decade. I was the one responsible for releasing it to the public. EJ Screen has race because if you were allowed to only use one data set in the United States of America to figure out which communities have the greatest health and wealth disparities, if you were only allowed to use one data set, scientifically, statistically, the one data set that will give you the best result is race. And that is, as Horace was pointing to, a result of generations of color-based discrimination in our country, resulting in those health outcomes persisting to this day. EJ Screen does not just use race, however, and it is not a decision-making tool. And I spent personally thousands of hours in my career ensuring that everyone at EPA and everyone in the public that was using EJ Screen did not inappropriately use it to make a decision. It is an analytical tool that helps you make better questions. In an enforcement case, it helps you understand, well, where are the communities that are probably suffering some of the most, so we can actually go in there and investigate and figure out what's going on. It was not used for the DENCA enforcement. You know why DENCA happened? Because DENCA had outrageous amounts of pollution. And some of that pollution, as of about 6 or 7 years ago, when the science came in and we finally found out exactly how carcinogenic it is, it was outrageous, and people live near it. It didn't matter that it was black people or white people or anybody else. People lived near it, and they were breathing in cancer every day. And it shouldn't be that way. That's why those cases were pursued. It wasn't just because DENCA was in a place like Cancer Alley. It was because we were not protecting the health of a community in the United States, and people were suffering from it. Do we use things like EJ Screen to better understand that and contextualize that? Yes. Do we use it to make decisions? No. That's why that part of EJ Screen was not used in the climate and economic justice screening tool. So there would be no confusion of that. That's why race was not in that tool, much to the consternation of the environmental justice leaders out there. It did not show up in that tool. It's why EJ Screen is not a decision-making tool. It's a question-asking tool. And to your first point about the misuse of these terms across the movement, I couldn't agree more. Many people that are lifted themselves up as EJ champions had no idea what they were talking about and misused and abused and confused a lot of these terms. But I want folks to be very clear. Environmental justice is not about preferencing folks so they get something special. It is about dealing with what I think I heard Horace talk about, the reasons why and the existence of these huge gaps, these huge disparities in our society. I don't know what to do with that, with your free market argument, Horace. That's just beyond me. I'm not a free market, whatever. But those things exist. And it's the job of the United States government to make sure that everyone in this country is equally protected. That's very clear in the Clean Air Act. That's very clear in the Clean Water Act. And we haven't achieved that. So we use all the data we have available to understand what that is. But as was clearly said, and as the Supreme Court has very clearly laid out, you do not use race to make the decisions in pursuit of that. And EPA never did.
Can I respond to that just briefly?
Okay, go ahead, Michael.
So I have trouble. I don't think FedSoc takes billions of federal dollars. I would be surprised if that's the case. But leave that aside for the moment. And the argument that, like, you consider race and sort of asking questions but not making decisions seems completely, like, I don't even really know what that means. And here's the thing about what the Constitution requires. The government usually cannot be trusted even to categorize people on race. And we've seen, I think this is Horace's main point, is like that the act of doing that is itself corrosive to our body politic. And so I don't think that there's a compelling interest for putting these, like, you may be right that, like, race tracks these other things. And if that, like, makes the government's job a little easier, I can see why that would be a shortcut. And that shortcut might make sense if we lived in a world that did not have the racial strife that led to, the 14th Amendment and the Civil Rights Act all being passed. My point is, you can look at those things, those health outcomes, those economic outcomes, where pollution's happening, and you can do things about it without having to consider race. And I do not trust the government to not preference people on the basis of race, because we've seen over and over how they do it. We saw this in Students for Fair Admission. We saw this with a lot of the rhetoric that was coming out of the Biden administration. And I candidly just don't agree that there is, like, some non-race-based way in which this was actually operating. That's, like, why I mentioned that Office of Inspector General thing. They said the quiet part out loud, and they have a chart, and it just says you should enforce the laws against these people more harshly. And I have clients who have said, you know, because of EJ Screen, we were told by EPA, by OECA, and by region, you know, various region folks that were inspecting or doing something with their facilities, that because of the racial makeup of the people around here, not because of wealth, not because of health outcomes, but because of race, that they are going to be holding us to a different standard. I think that's wrong. And if that's not what you meant to do, you know, it's too bad that that's not how it came out, Matt, because I think it's a good goal to deal with health outcomes and those sort of things. But I really just don't see this sort of pure not considering race thing actually playing out in how this was practiced.
I was mentioned a couple of times, and I want to make sure that my view is better understood. I do not believe that to be a Black person means that my achievements or lack of achievements can be traced to the existence of slavery, nor can it be traced to Jim Crow or even to generalized discrimination. Policies that attempt to rely on that thesis are very dangerous. If you look during the post Civil War era, you will see ups and downs in terms of the lifespan of Black Americans, the employment of Black Americans, the wealth assets of Black Americans. It can't be true that in the middle of the period between the end of the Civil War and today, that there was this nirvana period that was so amazing that led to more Black Americans owning houses per capita than do today. It can't be true that the percentage of Black men who were employed, there were periods of time when the Bureau of Labor reported to be Black and male meant that you were the most likely to be employed in the country. It can't be true that those things happen, and yet today when we look and we see outcomes that we don't understand and that we find unhappy that we're when we observe them, that they can be traced back to this. We would be far better served to look at what are the time-tested techniques for creating wealth generation. And that is the reliance on the market. We supported the Students for a Fair Admissions case. We submitted our brief on in support of the litigants in this case, precisely because we think the taint of race as a way of explaining who is admitted, who is succeeding, is simply untested. And environmental justice, to whatever degree that it does, appears to want to incorporate some aspect of this untested notion that the race of people today explains their situation. I think there's a lot more that needs to be done, and Mr. Kendi's work doesn't come close to accomplishing that.
John, I was going to turn to you. You seem like you might be in one of the better positions to try to provide some perspective, but also some thoughts on how do we accomplish the goal of fixing problems, cleaning up messes, as you said, without getting into the racial politics of all of this. Is it, do we get, you know, and do we focus on enforcement rather than grant funds and all that kind of thing, and where do you see this going forward with the states and whatnot?
I'm a little afraid that our audience listening to this would somehow be confused about the broader issues, affirmative action, DEI issues, the Supreme Court case, and the far narrower and different environmental justice issues. One of the things that I hope would be clear to our audience is environmental justice has no federal statutory basis to it. Never, it has not. There's been executive orders in and out, but those were never used, could not be used in filing federal complaints. Congressional Research Service just put out a paper indicating what I think was obvious, but maybe it isn't. And that is, just because you take away, because you do that, but you take away the executive orders on environmental justice, does not mean that the underlying statutes go away. The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, those statutes still require an analysis of overburdening communities. So if you're setting Clean Air Act national ambient air quality standards, you have to consider subpopulations. That is how this played out. I was chief of enforcement. We never put in a complaint anything about racial issues. We put in violations, and that's what a judge or jury was going to have to determine. It did not matter one whit what the population was. It was what the statute required. That's the proof that has to be done. Horace might be entirely right about market forces. I'm a big proponent of market forces, but that's not environmental justice. Environmental justice, remember my view. We're trying to give voice to the voiceless, try to take care of communities, and remember my last point, and enforce the law. And that law is still there. We take away the executive orders, the law is still there, the requirements are still there, just like they were before, and that's going to be our future. I want to add one other thing for our audience, just because we're talking just at totally at the federal level. There are multiples of states now who are either doing things because of their constitution, in several cases, three or four states, because they have statutes, and many of them have programs. You can go on to a website and download the environmental justice requirements of every state. But those of you who are practicing in this area, as I do, make sure you do not look just at the federal level, look at state levels, because there's a lot happening. I was just with the New Jersey director of their EPA saying that, you know, we have to look at that in the context of permits And it's the issue we're talking about, not doing worse to overburden, which is an economic issue, not a racial issue, overburden communities. That's what we're looking at in the context of permit issues. So I just want our audience to know it's more than federal, it's state issues. And just because we rescind the term, it doesn't mean the underlying requirements go away. They don't.
Matt, so what's to prevent now that you know, with the President Trump's executive order and the flow down through EPA and DOJ and you know, EJ, you know, the office being closed and whatnot, what's to prevent still OECA, the enforcement office at EPA, from going after a, you know, a polluter, either, you know, water, air, whatever, that happens to be doing so in a, you know, in what would otherwise be considered an EJ community? I mean, I guess, you know, is there some middle ground here that could be constructive where, you know, some of the things that, you know, criticisms that Horace, say something nice about Horace.
I'm not trying to undermine your free market thing. Like, I just don't. That's like way out of my universe, man. So I'm just not following it entirely. Boy, to try to answer your question though, if you were to look at anything that EPA does, whether it's enforcement or rulemaking or permitting, which largely, to John's point, EPA doesn't do. 96% of the permits in the United States are issued by state and local governments and a handful of tribes. But if you're going to look at any of those things, especially enforcement, though, like that's a key one, right? If you were to prioritize your enforcement in the places where there are the greatest health disparities related to excessive exposure to pollution, you will spend almost every day, all day, in black and brown communities and low-income white communities, because that's where those issues exist. If you never even open your eyes to see the color of the people or the wealth of the folks around you, that's where your enforcement inspectors are going to be every single day. So there's nothing preventing this or any other administration from showing up in those places other than their desire not to, for whatever political or other reason that I think are pretty bogus. To Michael's point earlier, a couple things that he said. I don't doubt. I would be shocked if it wasn't the case, Michael, that you have had clients come to you saying we're being enforced against because there's black people that live around our facility. I would be shocked if they weren't telling the truth, because somebody from EPA showed up, you know, one of the actual investigators who's out there doing this stuff, saying, well, you know, this is, you know, we're out here because y'all are operating in a black community. They're not right. But I would be surprised if that wasn't actually said, because this is hard. It's so hard to get folks to understand how to appropriately, from a government place, according to our laws and Supreme Court decisions, how to appropriately handle, understand, and talk about these things. Going back to something, Michael, I'm not sure if you or Horace talked about, you know, our political candidates and other folks who don't always use these terms or understand these concepts very with a lot of dexterity. I would completely expect for folks to show up and say that they're out there because of this, but they aren't understanding why they're out there. They're out there because those are the places where we need enforcement investigators the most. They're the places where there's the most pollution. They're the places where people are being most affected by those pollutions. Well, to the other point, though, one of the ways I've always tried to get folks to understand, and I hope this helps folks, because this is what I kept trying to get folks in the last administration to think about this with. It's the same concept that I think most of us are fairly familiar with in terms of hiring. Right. None of our organizations, whether you're a private organization or a public organization, none of our organizations are supposed to legally and should not be hiring folks because they're black or hiring folks because they're a woman versus a man. Right. Even though that's another huge disparity in this country, you're not supposed to do that. I'm pretty sure, though, and I hope most, if not all, of our organizations are looking at well, what does our staff look like? Right? What is our percentage of women around here? What is our percentage of people of color around here? How many indigenous folks do we have working for us? And when those numbers don't look, you know, anywhere close to kind of representative of our society, I think most organizations say, well, we need to do something about that. Like, we're only 15% women. Why do we have such a gender imbalance? That doesn't mean they go out there and they start hiring women, but it does mean, like, you know, is it the way we're advertising? Is it our recruitment? Is it the language we're using in our job postings? Is it the sorts of jobs that we have? Are there other things we can do here to be an organization that is welcoming and attracting to and really having that sort of composition to it? It doesn't mean you use those things when you're making the decision of who to hire, because you still need to hire the best person. But are you getting the best candidates to make that decision from? Are you getting a diversity of candidates to make that decision from? It was the same thing in the last administration. Didn't use race to make those decisions, but we wanted to look at the outcomes of those decisions. We wanted to see, after the decision was made, who benefited from it? Who's not being protected? And then look upstream of that and think, well, why is that the case? Is it because our algorithm for how we distribute water infrastructure money in the United States doesn't look at risk, doesn't look at harm, is just looking at population size, is just looking at tax base? Because that's how some of those state equations worked. And when folks looked at it, they're like, wow, we're getting all this money for water infrastructure, and there's five communities in our state that don't have drinking water. And when we look at the way the equation actually works, they're never going to get drinking water because they're rural places or they're poor places. But wow, they really have big needs for drinking water. How can we actually look at the way we use these resources to get them to have a little bit of drinking water? Right? That's what was happening in the last administration. I don't think many folks have I don't know if that's not free market or not, but I don't think many folks have a problem with government understanding who is benefiting and who is not protected and trying to do something about it.
Well, I do have a problem. That's exactly what I've been trying to explain.
I'm so sorry. I got it wrong.
Race is an idiosyncratic basis for making decisions. If I were to buy a new pickup truck, I wouldn't contact the manufacturer and find out what shift when this truck was made were more blacks working, so I could get the one that had the black Americans that were working on it. If I were buying a house, I wouldn't do that. In fact, it's such an idiosyncratic thing. Our organization, Project 21, was formed with the idea that in the 21st century, it would be the project of America that we would stop this unnecessary focus on race. If there's a poison in the stream, go after the poison in the stream. How many people who are left-handed live near the stream is irrelevant. These types of idiosyncratic choices are distorting our ability to move forward. And as we've heard Michael say earlier, there is an odious effect or impact in our society whenever we use race as some sort of measure. We need to move away from this idea. And whether we want to admit it or not, environmental justice is in fact infused with CRT, critical race theory. And yes, this idea of needing to notice what our workforce looks like, of what our policy impacts will be, it is dangerous. And every society, not just America, every society that has attempted to use race as a measure, it has not worked out well. Thomas Sowell has written about a 500-year practice of using race and watching how harmful these effects are. So no, I don't agree that even the government needs to be noticing. It's an idiosyncratic preference, and it ought to be ignored.
So, Michael, we're running up against the clock here, but you know, obviously, there's disagreement here, and that's the whole point of this. But the part that I think I'm hearing at least some agreement on is getting back to what John said about cleaning up your mess and about, you know, race blind, you know, enforcement of things where the worst stuff is happening. I mean, you know, not to put, you know, very poor words in your mouth, John, but Michael, any, you know, final, let me just, yeah, we haven't heard from you for a little bit. Let me see if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, I do. Let me pivot off of something Matt said about, like, he's not surprised that there's confusion about this. Seems to me the pretty easy way to eliminate the confusion is just to eliminate consideration of race. And what is, you know, what's so hard about that? You know, and you ask for evidence, and this has gone all the way up to the courts that have gotten this wrong. It's a case called Standing Rock versus U.S. Army Corps. I'm just going to quote it. The purpose of environmental justice analysis is to determine whether a project will have a disproportionately adverse effect on minority populations. So, like, if even the courts are confused, maybe it just needs to have the racial element completely taken out of it. And that's all that I read these executive orders and memos to do. And so, you know, I think it's something, if Matt's wanting to eliminate confusion and take race out of this, that he should be happy with that. And I don't understand the notion that, like, you can consider race, but not consider race. Like, you look around and see, like, take a look at the color of people around you and then somehow not discriminate on the basis of race. Like, if you're taking it into account, you're making decisions based on it. And, you know, as a constitutional matter, and I think also as a moral one, that's wrong.
All right. Well, thank you. And I'll turn it over to Edie. You know, thank all of you for joining us today. It's, you know, definitely a controversial topic, and, you know, but it's a very important one, and everybody has, you know, a lot of great experience and thoughts in this world. So very much appreciate it. And Edie, it's all you.
Yeah. On behalf of the Federalist Society, thank you so much to Michael, Horace, John, and Matthew for speaking with us today, and to John for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.